When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
And here we go. Welcome to the Zonal Marking Podcast Euro 2020 Preview Part 1. We are brought to you by The Athletic. This is, as ever, me, Ali Maxwell, joined by Michael Cox. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Ali.
And Tom Warville. Good day, Tom.
Hey, Ali. How's it going?
Very well. Fair to say that after a week off the pod, I'm heading into this episode and this weekend with a heady mixture of excitement, a lot of intrigue as well. We've left domestic club football behind and it's time to talk Euros. And thankfully, you guys are laden with all the knowledge, the research, the opinions that we need to break down this competition in the zonal marking way. So Michael's going to do what he does, balancing detail and conciseness to give us an overview of each team, their tactics, mentioning their manager perhaps. And Tom, we've appointed you our head of technical scouting and recruitment analysis. And what that really means is you're going to pick out a player from each team, not the obvious superstars, not the star names, but rather the ones our listeners should be watching out for over the coming weeks. You've dug them up using data, their numbers and some interesting player profiles. So on this episode, we're talking groups A, B and C. And less than a day after this goes live, you'll be able to find the subsequent episode profiling groups D, E and F. But it's going to be, yeah, quick fire and hopefully with some nice detail for you. And we're leaning on Michael to start with, talking about Group A, which includes Italy, Switzerland, Turkey and Wales. Michael, you wrote six brilliant previews for each group for The Athletic this week. And in each intro for each group, there was a theme of sorts. And for Group A, the theme was, you just quite like the look of this group, quite a tough one to call, quite tight.
Yeah, I think two themes, that and I think the lack of really good strikers as well is a bit of an issue. I mean, the exception in this group is Turkey, who have Burak Yilmaz up front, who actually I think is probably a decent outside bet for the top goalscorer award after his season at Lille. But he's, what, 35, 36 now? Something crazy. The other teams, I think, is a big question mark about the centre forward. So, yeah, there's to be honest, I think you can say that for the tournament as a whole. I don't think there's a great number of really established centre forwards for many teams throughout this competition. But yeah, that's quite apparent in Group A.
A lot of people fancying Romelu Lukaku to win top goal scorer, Harry Kane, of course, and Mbappe. But it is a factor of some of the other sides as well. Let's look at Italy. They're obviously favourites to win this group. They'll have all three group games at the Stadio Olimpico, while the others flit between Baku in Azerbaijan and Rome, of course. So they come into the tournament in some form as well, with Roberto Mancini as their manager. He has the best win ratio of any Italy manager to have managed over 20 games, but their general major tournament record since their 2006 World Cup win is somewhat patchy. Quarterfinal in 08, group stage exit 2010 and 2014 World Cup. Didn't even qualify for the 2018 World Cup. They were runners-up, of course, dismantled by Spain in the final of Euro 2012 and reached the quarterfinals in 2016. So a bit of form, some favourable conditions, but certainly with a point to prove having missed the last World Cup. Michael, does Mancini's side look suited to tournament football?
Yeah, I think they do. And I like their competitive record as well. I mean, you mentioned it in past tournaments, but you look at qualification for this, they didn't lose a game. Nations League, they didn't lose a game. And so far in World Cup qualifying, they haven't lost a game. And I think we sometimes tend to look at all these teams and look at the players and think, well, I know him, he's a good player. But actually how they perform on the pitch together as a group, I think, is really important. And Italy, I think, have got a really, really strong unit. As you say, they've got home advantage as well. As I say, the only question I really have about them is up front. I think even there, they've got options they can bring in. Probably Immobile and Belotti are going to be the two major ones. But, I mean, they've got a lot of really good wide players, which you never really associate with Italy over the years. Central midfield, I think Jorginho, Verratti, when he comes back from injury, and Barella is pretty much as strong as you're going to get in the tournament. Chiellini and Bonucci at the back, we know have been a solid pairing or part of a trio for many years, and Donnarumma in goal. The spine of the team is very, very good. Not entirely sure about the fullbacks.
Are the wide areas perhaps the obvious weakness, just in terms of looking at the names on paper?
Yeah, I mean, what they do very well is they play a kind of hybrid system. So, you know, like a few teams we've seen over the last couple of years, particularly Juventus actually in Italy, the fullbacks have different jobs. The left back, who somewhat surprisingly is going to be Emerson, that's the Chelsea Emerson, overlaps a lot, and Florenzi tends to hold his position more. And then out wide, you've got Chiesa on the right, who hugs that touchline, and Insigne comes inside more. So you end up with almost a front five, and the two wide players are one fullback and one winger, so Emerson and Chiesa. And then you have Insigne, Barella, and whoever the forward is in more central positions. So they do have a kind of familiarity and a cohesion that I think not many other sides do. And I think they're really well placed to do well at this tournament. Yeah.
So if they were one of the sides you mentioned who maybe has a question mark over the number nine position and who will score goals from that position, could that be slightly mitigated by the fact that their wide attacking players are sort of pure goal threats rather than out and out chalk on the boots old school wingers?
Yeah, definitely. Insigne in particular can come inside and loves bending the ball towards the top corner from the inside left position. Chiesa, I think, is going to play on the right, but he's very much a goal threat regardless of where he plays. And Barella as well, who actually his numbers aren't quite as good as I expected looking at how many league goals he's scored. But for Italy, he's done really well, scored a great goal, or rounded off a great goal in a 1-0 win over the Netherlands with a good header. And I think could be one of the real star players at this tournament, actually. So, yeah, I really like him. I think I would be surprised if they didn't get to the semi-final. And also, they've got a manager in Mancini who, you know, there's not many managers at this tournament who have real experience of managing big clubs and winning titles and that kind of thing. Mancini is one of the, you know, one of the ones with a good track record. So yeah, I fancy Italy.
And it's two thumbs up for Nicolò Barella, Tom, because he's our Italian player to watch.
Yeah, absolutely, Ali. I think Barella is definitely one to watch. And I mean, there's a lot of hype, a lot of speculation in the Italy camp that he could be their star as well. And I kind of, yeah, picking up on Michael's comment about his numbers not being too good, I'm intrigued that I think part of the reason for that is because he's playing behind Romelu Lukaku and Lautaro Martinez, who are the prime goal threats for Inter, and he's not been a huge scorer in his career. But what I think he does so well is kind of shuttles the ball between the defence and the attack, and is just a very, very good progressor of the ball, both in terms of carrying it forwards, as a passer as well. He excels at that too. And looking at the numbers on FBref, which are powered by StatsBomb, which is something we'll refer to a lot in this podcast, he has 7 progressive passes per 90, which is in the 95th percentile for all midfielders. So that shows just how much that he's able to get the ball forwards, you know, either through the lines or getting it into the box and things like that. So yeah, I think that in a midfield of Verratti, who obviously is technically excellent and very good under pressure, Jorginho, who kind of will be the metronome of this team, I think that Barella offers something completely different. And yeah, excited to see how he plays for Italy.
What a stylish group of midfield players this Italy squad contains. They're up against Switzerland in this group. Michael, they've actually been to 9 of the last 10 major tournaments, and as a nation, a footballing nation, I should say, have made great strides really since the turn of the millennium. Before that, they were rarely seen in these tournaments. But despite their presence in recent major tournaments, they haven't got past the round of 16 in any major tournament since the 1954 World Cup. What chance that they could trouble the scorers this summer under manager Vladimir Petkovic?
Yeah, I like Petkovic. I mean, he did a good job at Lazio, so he'll be going back to the Olimpico there for the game against Italy. He's been in charge of Switzerland for a long time now. I find it difficult to make a case against them doing anything other than what we've seen them do in recent tournaments, really. I think they'll get out of the group. Can't really see any reason why they will progress further than that. They've changed system. I think at the last tournament they were using a back 4. Now it looks like they're going to be a back 3. couple of question marks there. I think Fabian Scher is going to be fit, which means Rodriguez will probably play as a left wing back rather than as a left sided centre back, which I think is very much more suited to playing out wide, isn't he, with his crossing. They are good in the centre of the pitch. I like the combination of Xhaka and Freuler a lot. I think they just work really well. Xhaka sits there left of centre. His passing range is very good. I think he plays better generally for Switzerland than he does for Arsenal. And Freuler, who people will know from Atalanta, good up and down box-to-box midfielder. They're still very dependent on Shaqiri for creating chances. They used to be very dependent on Shaqiri for scoring goals. His scoring rate in his first 40, 50 international games is really good, but it's dipped significantly. And neither Mbolo nor Seferovic really are prolific, although I do like the combination of them. Again, I like Mbolo's pace and Seferovic. I think he's quite an intelligent player. So yeah, I just think we'll see more of the same from Switzerland. They are one of the most reliable sides in international football, aren't they? And I can imagine last 16 is potentially where we'll see them go out again.
Second nation in a row, Tom, where Michael has mentioned the player that you want to talk about, Brail Mbolo, our Swiss man to watch.
Yeah, Mbolo's an interesting one because, I mean, he was very, very hyped at Basel younger in his career and moved to Schalke and didn't really set the league alight there, even though on paper that felt like a decent step up. It's not as aggressive in terms of the step up in quality like the Premier League would have been. It probably suited him as well, where he'd be able to see a lot of time on the pitch as a 20, 21-year-old. But I moved to Mönchengladbach a couple of summers ago, and I think that's really helped his career and probably helped him get back on track and get back to where we thought he might be now as someone who's, I think, 24 years old versus where we thought he could have been at a few seasons ago when he was, at Schalke at Basel. So really hard-working striker up front, pressures a lot, is very keen at closing players down. And I think that we linked him in the past as a potential, Firmino replacement or backup because he does a lot of the things that Firmino looks to do in that sense. So yeah, 18.6 pressures per 90 is in the 85th percentile, which shows you, that's a pretty high number. But also he mixes that with getting into good goal scoring positions as well. So I think that his XG per 90 on non-penalty shots is a smidgen over 0.5, which again, really, really good, and shows that he's able to mix the workload out of possession with actually getting into goal scoring chances as well. So whereas we probably peg Firmino more as a false nine and someone who does more of the defending than the attacking, I think Brail Mbolo is able to do a bit of both. So yeah, expect to see him, pressing from the front. I think he's far more mobile than Seferovic is, maybe not as good in the air, but that should be a decent partnership for Switzerland. And like Michael said, with Shaqiri's goal scoring record falling off, could be an important source of goals this tournament.
Now, I'm quite intrigued by this Turkey side, also in Group A. Michael, in your preview piece, you described them as falling perfectly into the category of dark horses. Now, I'm interested to know how you define that phrase, because it's subjective in a way, who sort of qualifies as a dark horse. What is it about Turkey that made you write that about them?
Yeah, I think we're past the stage where we can call Belgium dark horses every year, aren't they? Now they've got some of the best players in Europe. I say that really because, I mean, they got to the semi-finals in 2002 and they got to the semi-finals in 2008, and they've only qualified for one other tournament in the last 20 years. So it just feels like either they get to the tournament and they're really good or they don't get there at all. I find it difficult really to work out this Turkey side. I mean, just even if you just look at the score lines, in qualification, they were winning a lot of games to nil, keeping a lot of clean sheets. And in the last year or so, in friendlies in the Nations League, they've had, I think, 3-3-alls. They've won a game 3-2. They've had a couple of 2-2s. So they seem to have almost flipped from being a pretty defensive side to suddenly scoring and conceding a lot of goals. I mean, Gunes, who was in charge in 2002, generally likes attacking football. That's what he's been renowned for throughout his career. But he's surely going to try and keep things tight. And I think they do have one of the more formidable centre-back pairings in this tournament. Demiral, who's at Juventus, and Soyuncu at Leicester. I think they'll play at times on the break. And up front in Yilmaz, they've got the best centre-forward in this group by quite a long way. So yeah, I would say they're one of the more unpredictable sides in this tournament.
Well, because although they have Yilmaz, who's so experienced at international and club level, it's a bit of a new generation as well. Half of the squad have 15 caps or fewer in this Turkish side. But that experienced manager, Michael, Şenol Güneş, just talk me through his previous life as Turkey manager. He oversaw basically their greatest tournament moment, right?
Yeah, in 2002 when they got to semi-finals and finished third eventually. It was a weird tournament, that a lot of big sides going out early. But I mean, he's achieved a lot more than that as well. You know, he was at Besiktas for a few years and had great success there, and just seems to have got the group together. And I know that's a bit of a almost
great bunch of
generic
lads
thing. Yeah, it's a bit of a generic thing to say, but I've always got the impression that Turkey have struggled with that over the last 10 or 15 years. They've often had a really good generation of players that haven't always been on the same page. And I think I've only seen a couple of games they've played over the last year, 18 months, but at times their attacking movement is really good. And I think they'll be a relatively exciting side to watch.
I'm looking forward to learning a little more about some of those guys who I mentioned, half of the squad with 15 caps or fewer. But the Turkish player to watch, Tom, you couldn't move away from one of the better known Turkish players as well in Hakan Çalhanoğlu.
Yeah, I guess my role in this pod, Ali, was picking out the players who aren't the most well known and those who, you know, those who for an average viewer you wouldn't be that familiar with. But I think Çalhanoğlu's a tough one to miss out, just because with my head of recruitment hat on, his contract's coming in to an end this summer. You know, it's the potential that he could re-sign again at Milan, but he's been linked with Manchester United before, and dare I say Arsenal as well, who are also looking for another creative attacker. So I think there's a kind of a Premier League slant to why we care about him in this tournament. But also kind of profile wise, he's interesting that he can play as a number 10. He can play off the left or off the right. And he reminds me a bit of Bruno Fernandes in the way that he kind of stays out of the box quite a lot. Doesn't really look to take players one-on-one. He's quite neat with his passing. He's a threat from set pieces as well, which is obviously extremely useful and could be a good source of goals. And he loves shooting from range as well. Something that, again, in this parish, you probably care less about, value less, but I think from a fan's point of view it should be fun watching Çalhanoğlu trying to wind up from 20, 25, 30 yards.
Literally the one thing that springs into my mind every time I see his name is a goal that he scored, I think, for Hertha Berlin against Dortmund, a free kick with Weidenfeller in goal, which he hit from basically the edge of the centre circle. No wall or anything. Everyone else is just kind of milling around and he just strikes it. And because of the way he can strike the ball, which is with that knuckleball motion, Weidenfeller just has absolutely, he hasn't got a Scooby what's going on, and it flies past him into the top corner while he's moving the other way. So hopefully we could see him recreate that. I'm not sure whether they might have some slightly more technical set piece routines than that, but no, a player to watch for sure. And Wales round off this group, Michael. They finished top of their group in 2016, which I think sometimes gets forgotten. You had a Portugal team who won the tournament finishing third. Wales obviously with an historic performance to reach the semi-final, but they actually top their group with England, Russia and Slovakia. They beat Northern Ireland and Belgium in the knockouts as well before falling to the eventual winners, Portugal. What chance of a repeat here, Wales under Rob Page's management?
Yeah, I don't think they're as good a side as they were 5 years ago. Obviously, it's been a strange time for them, Rob Page taking over slightly unexpectedly. The one thing I'd say about them is I think they've got tactical options. I mean, they've got a solid base at the back. They're going to play three-man defence as they did last time. Pretty solid in the centre of midfield. And then going forward, I mean, they've got Daniel James. They've got Gareth Bale. We know they've got tremendous speed to play on the break. And up front, they've got Kiefer Moore, who can offer a more direct option. He's good at bringing people into play. And then with Aaron Ramsey's runs from midfield as well, they do just have a lot of technical players, a lot of different tactical options that I think could be quite useful. So I think they're probably stronger than the sum of their parts. Obviously, matching a semi-final performance will be very tricky. But they're one of those sides that just because of the nature of the tournament, you would probably count on them to get out of the group.
What about how they will go about using Bale and Ramsey? Obviously, the two biggest names in terms of world football in the squad. But certainly in Bale's case, not having played a huge amount of football at club level this season, and off the top of my head has always had a slightly different role with Wales anyway. How do they get the most out of those two players while also remaining a really solid unit?
Yeah, there's various options. I mean, 5 years ago, they tended to play Bale and Ramsey in the front three, sometimes floating behind a main striker, sometimes Bale was the main striker. I think it's more likely at the moment that Ramsey is probably going to play as one of the two central midfielders. Bale will play kind of inside right role off the right. The interesting thing is, I mean, Moore, for anyone who hasn't seen him, plays for Cardiff and is, what, 6'5", I think he must be. And he's, you know, he's good with his feet as well. He's good with his back to goal. But when you look at the centre-backs in this group, I mean, I said earlier, I think Turkey have got a couple of really formidable centre-backs, and Italy as well. If you're playing up against Chiellini and Bonucci, I'm not sure you want to test them with a real 6'5" direct player. And what Wales have done over the last couple of years is they've varied it. Sometimes Daniel James has played up, you know, almost as a false nine. Bale, of course, can play there. Sometimes Harry Wilson has played there. All of these players float around more, make runs in behind more. So I almost feel a little bit sorry for Moore that they've got this kind of draw, because I think tactically it might be more suited to playing a rotating band of three players rather than having the fixed centre forward.
Sort of suggesting that, like an elephant being scared of a mouse rather than another elephant, Chiellini and Bonucci might not be scared of an elephant in Kiefer Moore, but someone like James running around their ankles, you know, darting in behind and pulling them this way and that would be more of an issue for them potentially.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say that to their faces.
No, nor would I, to be fair. And Tom, another championship player is our Welsh player to watch for the tournament.
Yeah, I guess something of a mouse potentially in David Brooks, who has fallen out of the spotlight a little bit since Bournemouth's relegation. And I don't think we saw too much of him in 2019-20 either. I think he was good in his debut season for Bournemouth in 18-19. But yeah, someone who, again, played at a very, very good level on a Bournemouth side, which, you know, wasn't amazing in 2018-19. I guess was reliant on a lot of Ryan Fraser and Callum Wilson's attacking, but I think he was a young bright spot there as well. But he's come back this season after some injury issues and has got 5 goals and 5 assists and averaging one or the other every 5 games or so. So not a huge return, but I think that, I mean, Brooks is turning 24 soon, so definitely out of the you know, younger end of his career. And this is probably, you know, a good time for him to show that he's still got it and still deserving of those kind of links beforehand to the likes of Manchester United and others. So yeah, I'm intrigued to see how Brooks plays. And I guess putting the question back to you, Ali, how, with your championship's hat on, how he's kind of performed this season?
Well, one of Brooks's problems has been staying fit for any proper length of time, not just this season, but I think previously as well. It's a tough one because players get labelled injury prone, where sometimes it can just be a run of poor luck. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's going to be an issue for him in his career to come, but it has just held him back a little bit over the last few seasons. But in full flow, he's brilliant to watch. He's brilliant in transition, carries the ball really well. He's like an eel sort of sliding through defences. I wonder if Bale is going to play off the right at times, whether that might slightly hinder Brooks's ability to get on the pitch. But certainly a brilliant player to watch. Also, won the Toulon tournament player of the tournament in 2017 wearing an England shirt. So that's 4 years ago. He was playing for England at the Toulon tournament, and here he will be representing Wales at Euro 2020.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Group B next, and that includes Belgium, Denmark, Russia, and Finland. Michael, something to be aware of in this tournament versus your average international tournament is a home advantage factor. I mean, we talked about home advantage quite a lot this season when it came to playing in empty stadia, but it's not really what we're talking about here. In this group, for example, because this is a pan-European tournament with a number of host cities, you've got Denmark, they have all three of their group games at home, and Russia have two of their three. So you sort of automatically feel a bit sorry already for those sides who aren't host nations.
Yeah, I think it's a major factor. That's what I focused on from a preview for this group. I mean, I don't think we've considered it enough. I think we've talked about this cross-continental thing in terms of fans getting around, then in terms of the COVID situation, obviously. But yeah, home advantage, it's changed massively. We've never had this kind of thing before in a tournament. And this is a very strange group where there's two sides who have home advantage, and then Russia go from having home advantage to being away against Denmark in the last game. So yeah, it's quite strange. But I think it's quite a fun group. I think there'll be some interesting matches here. And I guess it works out relatively well in the sense that Belgium are the best team, but they don't have home advantage. So there are, I think, three you know, all due respect to Finland, I think they've got an uphill task. But there's three sides, so I think we'll fancy finishing in the top two places.
Belgium, of course, have got Roberto Martinez in charge. They were the semi-finalists in Russia in 2018 at the World Cup. They lost 1-0 to France, a set-piece goal from Umtiti. They weren't a million miles away from the final there, were they? And England, of course, the other losing semi-finalist, they've gone through a huge overhaul since then in just 3 years. But almost by contrast, for Belgium, of the 14 players that played against France that day, the starting 11 and three subs, only Vincent Kompany, Marouane Fellaini and Moussa Dembélé don't feature this time around. Michael, is this a case of sort of strength in continuity or issues with emerging talent?
To certainly say the latter. I mean, it's a golden generation, isn't it? And golden generations do tend to stick around for maybe one more tournament than they should. Go back 10, 15 years, Belgium didn't really have any world-class players at all. And now they're getting to the stage where they're looking for the next generation. I'm not sure that they're there. But they do have, I mean, they have some fantastic players. De Bruyne is arguably the best playmaker in this tournament. Lukaku is arguably the best centre-forward in this tournament. I think there are question marks, particularly about the defence. I don't tend to put a big emphasis upon the age of players. But I think with Vertonghen and Alderweireld getting on a bit in terms of age, and the fact that Martinez wants them to play high up the pitch, he wants a high line, he wants to press, I do wonder whether they will be exposed a little bit in that respect.
That's interesting. So it's not necessarily, you know, Bonucci and Chiellini are quite old defenders, but it almost feels like the fact that they are Italian and the way that the Italian defences tend to play, it doesn't get held against them in a tournament like this. Almost it's a positive, their experience, their leadership. When it comes to Belgium, you're right, there's a lot of, oh, look how creaky their back line is. So is it, it's kind of dependent on how, whether they will be exposed because of that?
I think so. We know what Martinez is all about. He's never been the best at drilling a defence and keeping it tight. He does expect a lot of individual centre-backs. But I do think they have a few obvious strengths. I like them out wide in terms of wing-backs. There's a few sides playing a back three in this tournament. Belgium, I think, have probably better wing-backs than anyone because they can start with Meunier, who always does really well at international tournaments, and Thorgan Hazard. And then they can probably rotate and bring in Nasser Chadli, who again has done really well at some past tournaments, and Yannick Carrasco, who I think at times had an excellent season for Atleti. So, yeah, they've got lots of options out wide.
And who's their player to watch, Tom?
I think it's got to be Jeremy Doku, who's 19 years old, right winger, and he's someone who replaced Rafinha at Rennes back in 2019-20. Rafinha, of course, going to Leeds. And, yeah, he's one of those players who is a bit of the kind of Neymar YouTube highlight compilation star who is fantastic taking players on one-on-one. I mean, he does it 5.8 times per 90, completes it around 50 or just over 50% of the time. And volume-wise, like, that's up there in the top 5% of wingers in Europe. So he does a lot of dribbling, a lot of carrying, loves to try and beat players. But it's the classic, you know, no end product conundrum, which I think will come in the future. I mean, he's only 19. He'll add that to his game. So I think that, yeah, he's the youngest player in Belgian squad. He's their only, I think, under 23 player in there. So he's something of an outlier in that sense. And also, I guess, the rest of Belgian squad are just so good technically and just so good kind of on the ball. And maybe he's just so quite raw at his young age. But yeah, an exciting player to watch, someone to keep an eye on. Maybe won't make a big dent in this tournament, but if he, you know, classic, if he adds the end product to his game, then he probably adds another zero to his price tag, really. So, yeah, Jeremy Doku for me is the one to watch.
So now it's Denmark, who, as I mentioned, are playing all three of their games in Copenhagen. And had this tournament, Michael, been played when it was meant to be played last summer, Åge Hareide would have been their manager. And instead, it's Kasper Hjulmand. What are the strengths and weaknesses of this Danish side?
I think big strengths and big weaknesses. Strengths, very solid in defence, really good spine. I mean, they've got a host of really good centre-backs. I think the starters are going to be Kjær and Christensen, who I think had a really good season at Chelsea when he played. But also they've got Anderson, who again was excellent at Fulham, to come in, and Vestergaard as well. So they could shift to three at the back, I think, no problem there. But I think really central midfield, I mean, Højbjerg and Delaney is as strong, as physical, as commanding a central midfield duo as you're going to find. Christian Eriksen obviously playing the number 10 role. and a couple of good overlapping fullbacks as well. The problem is up front, or going forward, I should say, more broadly, I think they're struggling. They don't have a good centre forward. I've said before that I don't think that's necessarily a barrier to doing well. I think it's going to be Jonas Wind up front. But the problem really is that Braithwaite and Poulsen haven't really started that much this season, or haven't played much this season. And obviously there's a balance to be found. You don't want tired players going into a tournament, but you do want players who've kind of played themselves into form. And I don't think they have that. But that said, I think they are probably the most befitting side of the Dark Horses tag, because I think they'll keep things tight. I don't think they'll concede goals. I would fancy them to get a goal from somewhere going forward, maybe set pieces. They've got centre-backs who are good in the air. They've got Christian Eriksen, who's a very good set-piece taker. So yeah, I fancy them. I think they're in better shape for a tournament than I can remember for a long, long time. Obviously won it in 92. I guess 98, they're a decent side. But yeah, they look in very good shape to me.
Could follow the Greece 2004 blueprint. Who would be their Trinos Delas scoring those goals from set pieces? I mean, just a more general question, Michael, at international level, when it comes to major tournaments and, you know, how different the football is compared to what you might look for when building a team at club level. Of course, you don't really have a choice of building a team anyway. You kind of get what you're given at international level. Is it preferable, let's assume you can't be a complete team and you have to have a weakness somewhere, is this the right way round? You know, having a really good, solid defensive unit, good midfield players, and maybe lacking a little bit at the very top of the pitch, rather than maybe a few other teams at this tournament who got some quite eye-catching attacking players that we all know and love, but maybe lack a little at the other end of the pitch.
Yeah, I think so. It's about not losing, isn't it? I mean, Portugal, with a great example of that, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, didn't win any of their three group games, as you mentioned at the top. I mean, it's interesting though, because Kasper Juhlmann's come in and, I mean, he's a much younger, much more progressive coach than Horaider. I mean, so that you can look at it either way. You can say that they've got quite a positive-minded coach, but not necessarily the attacking players. It's a funny kind of situation, but they do look a good side to me. And I think clean sheets are important. And Kasper Schmeichel, I think, had a really good season, didn't he? And brilliant in the FA Cup final as well. You need someone who's going to keep clean sheets, and I don't think there's too many better goalkeepers in this tournament than Schmeichel.
And Tom, which player might I fall in love with? I assume they're wearing Hummel-made kits, which is always a good start for me. Which player am I going to be frantically Googling at halftime of their first game?
Yeah, I think, again, he's probably a bit more of a niche option that may not see too much time on the pitch, but Mikael Damsgaard is the one that is a bit of a numbers sweetheart, really, just because he's one of those wingers who is really hardworking and puts a lot of, you know, effort and energy in off the ball, and he pressures more than any other player in Europe or any other winger in Europe on a kind of per 90 basis, and disrupts opposition moves a ton as well when we look at some of the data from Smarter Scout as well. But his output is similar to that of kind of Lucas Moura and Andros Townsend, and those guys are kind of, I guess, more functional wingers who, yeah, do this, you know, offer the same sort of stuff off the ball, but with the ball at their feet, don't actually contribute a lot in terms of goals and assists. And he's seen his numbers drop quite a bit from leaving FC Nordsjælland in Denmark to moving to Sampdoria, where he plays now. 11 goals and 6 assists last season, down to 2 goals and 4 assists this season. But I think he could make an impact off the bench, and you know, with the 5 subs rule, I think being able to have someone who just is a box of energy coming onto the pitch and using him as either a very high pressing fullback or even a high pressing winger is a nice option to have. And I think, yeah, Damsgaard could play that role really, really well.
Russia have Stanislav Cherchezov as the coach, former national team goalkeeper in the 90s. And they're one of those sides, Michael, whose players mostly play in their own domestic league. And that's a league that we are not naturally exposed to, I suppose. So what sort of a squad do you think Cherchezov has at his disposal?
Don't fancy him much in defence individually. I think they've got problems there. Going forward, I think they're quite exciting. I mean, I expect most people will know or remember Alexander Golovan. He's now at Monaco, really good player on his day. I think that's the key factor. And I like Maranchuk as well, who's had a kind of bit part role at Atalanta, but occasionally looked really good. And then up front, they've got Zoiba, who his international record is excellent. I think he's got 29 goals and 50-odd games. Was dropped from the side midway through last season, as people might have read about, because of an explicit video leak, which is the second most notable explicit video-related story after the kind of Benzema blackmail thing, I suppose. But he's back in the side, back in the captain's armband. And I tend to think strikers like him, and by that I mean a very tall, aerial force. I think they're more useful international level and club level. I think teams defend deeper. I think build up play is a bit simpler. And he's the kind of player where if he has a good tournament, you never know how far they can go. But I just think they'll concede too many goals. I don't like the look of their defence. There's a few positional things I'm uncertain of. Yuri Zhirkov is still getting in the defence, which Chergyshov has really had to go out of his way to defend his place there. The goalkeeper situation is weird as well. They've had three or four number ones over the course of about 18 months. Going to go with Anton Shunin. I must say, I know very little about him, but he's 34 now.
Question was always, what will happen after Akinfeev? And what you're telling me here is they still haven't really worked out the answer. It sounds like sounds like you could say the same about the Berezovsky twins as well.
Yeah, pretty much. I think they were briefly considering bringing back Akinfeev, and they had a spell with Guilherme, Brazilian-born goalkeeper. But yeah, have gone back to Shunin, or have turned to Shunin, I should say. And yeah, like I said, I'm not speaking about this from any great authority because I haven't seen him play very much. But sometimes you look at a player and you think, he's 34, he hasn't got that many caps. You wonder really what that's all about. So yeah, as I said before about Denmark, I place a big emphasis on keeping it tight at the back. I don't think Russia will do that. What they will do well is, I think I'll change system. Chergyshov is a good tactician. I'd be surprised if they named a single unchanged 11 in this tournament. And I think they'll probably play at least two or three formations as well.
And who could be the standout player? Who could be the one that makes things happen for them, Tom?
I think the obvious answer here, usually with Russia in the tournament, is up to this point probably Alan Zagoev, who as soon as I think of Russian national team, I always just think of him and thinking, oh, he must be an exciting young talent who still hasn't moved away from CSKA Moscow, and he still hasn't. But no, it's not Zagoev this time. It's going to be Alexander Golovin, who similarly to Zagoev has had his injury issues of late, but this season in Ligue 1, when he's featured, he's been fantastic. I mean, it's in limited minutes. I think he's played about 11.90s worth of minutes, so just around 1,000. He's put up the best combined expected goals and expected assist numbers of any player in the league, even higher than Kylian Mbappe and Neymar. So yeah, it's been very, very effective when on the field. Very versatile. He can play as kind of an inside forward on the left. He can play as a number 10. He can play on the left of a midfield three. And I just really like him in tight spaces. He's really nice. He's a good passer of the ball. He's happy to carry it as well. And yeah, I think there's a lot to like about Golovin. And again, fitness is a question, but of course, again, with the subs, maybe they don't have to eke every single minute out of him in this tournament. But I think if things are going to come from that midfield, it's probably him that it's going to come through.
Always nice to welcome a major tournament debutant, Michael. That's what we have in Group B with Finland. What got them through qualification for this tournament, and how can we expect them to approach things?
Good organisation, really good tactics. I think they will probably play three at the back, but they can play 4-4-2 as well. I found them difficult really to work out in the games I watched them. They're not spectacular going forward, but they are very well organised defensively. I think they will probably be dominant in terms of possession for all three of their group games. They will try to play relatively quickly up to the four players. Timo Pukki, everyone knows about, so I won't talk about him. I think Urunen down the left flank is maybe a player who could be quite exciting, can overlap and get crosses in. Yeah, they kind of said, I expect them, I think if you said to them, how many goals do you want in this game ahead of each of the games, they'd have a think whether it's between 0 goals or 1 goal. You know, either they're playing for 0-0 or they're trying to nick a 1-0 win. I don't think they'll be outclassed, but I'm struggling really to make a case for them going far in this tournament, I must say.
And obviously, Teemu Pukki is their star and a brilliant finisher. They've also got another young Finn who's a brilliant finisher, Marcus Force. It might be hard to get them both on the pitch at the same time, Tom, given what Michael's just said about the way they will probably approach games, with both of these players being pretty much out and out number nines. But Force could be a real difference maker off the bench. He's got a real eye for goal.
Yeah, absolutely. He's someone who gets into fantastic scoring positions. His XG per 90 of 0.61, I think, was the fourth best in the championship among players with 500 minutes or more. So I think part of that is inflated a bit from him being a substitute for Brentford this season. But he's been, great at getting into those positions when on the field. The other thing as well, which I find quite interesting, is he barely touched the ball for Brentford. I mean, they're a side who have a fair amount of possession, and maybe it's just the way that, that their strikers look to play, but I think even Tony had a lot more touches than Forza's 25 per 90, and only four strikers managed fewer in the Championship this season. So yeah, shows that it may be something of a poacher, but looking through his goals, I mean, he's someone who just has a very clean strike of the ball, and yeah, offers something probably a bit different to Pukki, who, you know, times his runs really well and has a very specific kind of goal that he scores. But Forza also is not just a striker. I think he's played on both wings of Brentford this season and as a kind of a more advanced midfielder as well at times too. So a lot to like in there. He's only 21 years old, turns 22 on June 18th as well. So if he's one that we're not going to see too much of in the Euros, we should hopefully see him in the Premier League next season.
I hope we do have a moment where, and this is very much one where you need to subscribe to the view that any team chasing a game will have one chance at some point to level things up. If it does fall to Marcus Forss, then you'd be more confident than most that he'd put it away, that's for sure. Group C has the Netherlands, Ukraine, Austria, North Macedonia. And the inclusion of North Macedonia, and I suppose Finland as well, Michael, who we've just discussed, it reminds us about the expansion of the European Championships that came ahead of the 2016 tournament, where we expanded to 24 teams. Now, it has obviously had an impact on the very format, the structure of the tournament. I guess what are the consequences of that expansion? What do you think about them? Do they make the tournament better or do they make it worse?
I'm a little bit, how do I put it? I do kind of yearn for the days of the 16-team tournament just because it felt like every game mattered straight away. I mean, the interesting thing with North Macedonia, Finland qualified for this fair and square through the usual qualification. North Macedonia, of course, came from the Nations League D, which was really a kind of very unprecedented move from UEFA, saying, look, we're just going to almost hand out a place to one of the weaker European nations. And a lot of people were sceptical about that. I thought it was quite fun, but might produce a complete no-hoper. I don't think North Macedonia will be, actually. I think they're a decent side, really good organisation, and some good players in certain positions as well. So, yeah, I think this is the weakest group in the tournament, if we're being honest. The recent track record of these sides at tournaments is not very good. Even the Netherlands haven't qualified for the last two major tournaments, which is extraordinary considering their historical record.
I feel the need to say that my negative connotations weren't linked to necessarily the quality of the teams involved, more the fact that just the very nature of having 24 teams means that you play a whole group stage to lose only eight of them rather than chopping half the field, if you will. So it just causes kind of, I guess for me anyway, a suboptimal format. Rather than, you know, I have no issue with including any team that qualifies, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I do find the format for it slightly weird. We seem to have that with a lot of tournaments now. I mean, Women's World Cup is 24 teams. The Copa America is 12 teams. It is a problem in international football, I think.
Maybe not as egregious as this year's Copa America, where they have a 10-team group stage in order to cut two teams out of it and move forward with the quarterfinals from there. Anyway, we digress. I want to know about the Netherlands. It's their first major international tournament since the World Cup in 2014. They are another side with three home games, and I think there's an expectation that they'll glide through this group. Frank de Boer's their manager. Michael, how does he have them playing?
Yeah, it's a funny one with the Netherlands. There's some, you kind of look at the Netherlands and you always expect them to play the classic Dutch way. I'm not really sure they do under De Boer. There are a few typically Dutch things there. They've got good ball-playing centre-backs, even without Van Dijk. They've got very good central midfield players. What they really lack compared to the classic Dutch sides is real quality out wide. And I think going forward, they are relying a lot on Depay, who has been excellent over the last couple of years. Obviously, we didn't see the best of him in England. He's the kind of player I think can almost run the attack by himself. And I think he will be looking to receive the ball on the break and dribble past players and almost carry everything forward himself. They've also got Luke de Jong, who can come off the bench, probably off the bench rather than starting, to play a bit more of a classic number nine role. And I think they will. I fancy them very much to get out of this group because it's not a very good group. But it's probably not as strong a Dutch side as you would like to see on their return to a tournament after, what, 7 years away? Mm. Feels incredible, but yeah, 7 years away.
Amazing. I'm hoping for a big tournament from Memphis Depay, who you mentioned there. But Tom, they've also got another attacking wild card up their sleeve.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's Wout Weghorst. who I've had described to me as the wide Jamie Vardy, which is a fantastic nickname.
Sorry, the wide because of his build?
Because of his stature, right. Because of his build, yeah. Okay. Jamie Vardy is probably, you know, more of a beanstalk, and Weghorst is definitely a tree trunk compared to him. Tears around the pitch, you know, pressing from the front, and I mean, he's 6'5", so he is something of a train when he gets up to speed. Very, very good in the air, which makes him obviously a threat from set pieces and from crosses in open play as well, and plays very much like a target man, with a lot of kind of the passes that he makes being those kind of trying to bring other players into play. So, which feels, I guess, different to what we'd expect from the Dutch, and a big target man doesn't feel very total football-y. But he's also shown a variety of finishes in the Bundesliga this season. He's dinked the keeper a couple of times, which is always pleasing to see from someone who you don't expect to maybe have that as part of their game. But I think there's a fantastic profile. I mean, we've got an upcoming kind of big scouting project soon coming out on The Athletic, and as part of that, there's a bit of a bio on each of these players. And I think Weghorst has always had a bit of a chip on his shoulder that he was written off at a fairly young age and has slowly kind of come back year and year. And I think he scored double figures every single season for the last six seasons, and his mind is constantly battling the kind of detractors of against him, people who just didn't think he'd make it. So yeah, he's got a really interesting backstory, and I think that he offers the Dutch something different, maybe a slightly more mobile version of Luke de Jong. And yeah, he's definitely the pick for the one to watch, mainly because now everyone will be thinking that's why Jamie Vardy, as he's tearing around up front.
A good tournament this for tall, strapping centre forwards, isn't it? We've talked about Kiefer Moore, Juba, you've mentioned Weghorst there, and Kalajdzic, of course, we've mentioned a couple of times on this podcast as well for Austria. That is a nice wrinkle to this tournament. Ukraine next up. Michael, they've got Andriy Shevchenko in charge. How's he been as a national team manager? Because he sort of followed up a brief dalliance with politics to take over the national team. It's been an absolute roller coaster a decade or so for him after retiring from his playing days. And I mean, I must admit, for some of the preview content I've read, including your own piece, my dark horse radar is bleeping pretty loudly when it comes to Ukraine.
Yeah, would you like another towering centre forward, Alex?
Yes, please.
Well, they've got Roman Yaremchuk, who I believe has had a very good season with Genk. Must admit, I didn't see much of the Belgian league, but he's done well for Ukraine as well in terms of his goal-scoring figures. And yeah, I think they're all right. They've got a centre forward who can score goals at international level. I think the midfield is very good. Stepanenko, Malinovsky and Zinchenko. That works really well on paper, and from what I've seen, really well on the pitch as well. Their defenders are very much not household names, but they can keep clean sheets. Go back to October last year, they very much parked the bus against Spain and won 1-0. I think they can keep clean sheets against the likes of North Macedonia and Austria and perhaps Holland as well. And yeah, I think they're a decent side. They're unspectacular, but they're well organised. They seem to be all on the same page in terms of tactics. And yeah, I think they will get out of the group.
And our Ukrainian player to watch, Tom, has he got hints of Mr. Nicolò Barella, who we spoke about at the top of the podcast, in terms of the kind of profile of player that we're talking about here?
I think, I mean, Ruslan Malinovsky is the man in question. I think that they share a position, but I think that Malinovsky is far more technically gifted than Barella is. And I think, forgive me if I'm wrong, I can't remember who the teammate is. I think it's Jim City, the defender, who recently labelled Malinovsky as Malin Boomsky because of his cannon.
That's very Thomas Müller, isn't shot.
It is. You can imagine the meme now of kind of the Müller leaning over the interview mic and saying, in Ukraine we call him Malin Boomsky.
Nice.
He's got a excellent left foot when it comes to shooting. Shoots with a lot of power, so that's something to watch out for. And also, he went on a bit of an assisting streak when he was kind of in the team for Atalanta towards the end of the season. So he averaged, I think, 0.58 assists per 90, which when you think about the best players get around one assist every five games, and he was averaging more than one every two. He had a fantastic relationship with both Duvan Zapata, who he assisted six times in the league, and also Luis Muriel, who I think he assisted four times. So again, between the two of them, he's getting 9 or 10 assists out of them this season, and shows that there was a good relationship with the strikers there. But Malinovsky, not a ton of minutes, but a really good passer, great shooter, supplied a bunch of assists from different situations, whether they were kind of cute passes through the defence or kind of long range through balls from deep. So he's 28 now, so probably a bit sneakily old, and someone who is definitely into his prime now, so may not be, you know, have a a bunch of years left at the top level, but yeah, he's someone who's definitely worth watching. It will be the kind of creative spot for midfield for Shevchenko in Ukraine this summer.
They are joined by Austria in Group C, who haven't won a game at a major tournament since the World Cup in 1990. Michael, Franco Foda, the manager, he has one of those very fascinating and kind of international football specific questions, which is how to get the best out of your one world-class player, in this case David Alaba, who also happens to be insanely versatile and can play in a number of different positions. How does Foda go about getting the best out of Alaba and the best out of this team?
I don't know, and I'm not sure he completely knows either. I mean, I went back to look at three of their games from, when was it? Must have been the most recent international break back in March. And one of the games Alaba played left wing, one of the games he played central midfield, and one of the games he played left back. And of course, this is a player who I think the previous week or the week after I saw playing for Bayern Munich at centre back. So yeah, that does seem slightly odd to me. I think he will probably play left back, but Foda does like to chop and change in terms of systems. And I think we'll probably see him in a variety of positions. I find it difficult really to know what to make of Austria. At times they look well organised. You do look at their team and the likes of Sabitzer is a really good player. Baumgartner as well I like a lot. And Kaladzic up top has had a fantastic breakthrough year in the Bundesliga. He's one of those players who has benefited a lot from the tournament being delayed by a year. Yeah, I mean, Austria, funny side, aren't you? You mentioned their poor competitive record. I can't really see them going that far into this tournament. But again, in this group, I think chances are they will probably get out of it.
A sort of tactical adjacent question. Red Bull Salzburg, they've won 8 titles in a row in the Austrian top division, and around a third of this squad have played in the Red Bull system, if you will, either for Salzburg or for Leipzig in Germany or both. Do you think the playing style of the national team has been impacted by the Red Bull dominance of Austrian football?
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, that's probably the most interesting, or maybe the only interesting thing really about this Austria side. I think that has played a part, and I don't really expect to see that much pressing at this tournament overall. I just don't think you see that at international tournaments. I don't think you're going to get it after the season we've just had where everyone's knackered. But I think Austria, they're one of the few sides who might be defined more by their pressing than by what they do with the ball, really. Because, yeah, they don't necessarily have the best individuals in an attacking sense. But I do think they, when I've seen them, they press quite cohesively. So that's one thing to look out for. So, yeah, you're right, Ali. I think that has been a big boost to them. And I think potentially in the future could be a boost in terms of coaches as well. There do seem to be some interesting Austrian coaches coming through as well as players. But they are a funny side. Like I say, of all the teams in this tournament, I'd probably have them, Poland and Turkey as the sides I'm least sure of how they'll perform.
Interesting. Any players, Tom, that you're sure will perform pretty well at these Euros?
Yeah, Xavier Schlager, for me, the midfielder who plays at Wolfsburg, is definitely the one to watch. He's got quite a distinctive look. He's quite short. He's quite stocky. He's got this kind of big blonde ponytail as well. And he's just an absolute bruiser in midfield. I mean, very, very effective presser for Wolfsburg this season. Loves to kind of, you know, jump into tackles, very forward thinking with, you know, when he's in possession, either looking to beat a man and get it forward or pass forwards. So expect to see that when he kind of wins it back, and his first thought will usually be getting it forwards. And he loves a shot too, a trait that he shares with Marcel Sabitzer as well. So I think that Austria's midfield too, if he lines up alongside Konrad Leimer, there's a lot of energy in there, a lot of pressing. And like you say, Ali, that's kind of something that is born out of the Red Bull model. So yeah, Schlager for me is the one to watch, mainly because I think that he could be a really important player for them in this tournament, and also because I can't imagine it's too long before he's linked with a move to the Premier League and we get to see him more regularly.
Michael, North Macedonia, their manager Igor Angelovski, as you mentioned, they qualified via the Nations League, which is new, and I'd like to know how you think they'll approach their first European Championships. How will they set up? How will they try and progress?
They've played a couple of different systems. They've played either 4-2-3-1 or they've played 3 at the back. They, as you expect, they don't have great strength and depth. So often I think you'll see roughly the same combination of 11 players playing in two different systems. They're without Nestorovsky, who is actually a pretty handy number 9 up front, plays in Serie A, sometimes come on as a decent super sub. So it looks like they're probably going to play 3-5-2. Obviously Goran Pandev is one of the forwards. But they do have good quality in the midfield zone, actually. I'm not sure who Tom has singled out, but I imagine it will be one of the midfielders. Defensively, individually, they are... I'm not too familiar with them, aside from Alyovsky, must be honest. But their record in competitive games is pretty good, albeit against a relatively meagre opposition. But they did beat Germany 2-1 earlier this year, and I think that is a real warning shot for the other sides in this group. You know, they're not there just to make up the numbers. And I do think that having a side who has come through, albeit a lowly Nations League group, it's just in the habit of winning games. They have a good competitive record. I don't think that should be sniffed at. And I'd almost fancy them over someone who has kind of sneaked in through, you know, getting mediocre results in the proper qualification. So I'm really interested to see how they do, because I think it's an interesting experiment, really, throwing in someone who didn't qualify through the normal route. And like I said, I don't think they'll be outclassed, and I think they're in the right group, because I think this is probably the weakest in the tournament.
Again, you mentioned that they will likely play a 3-5-2, a 3 or 5 at the back system, however you like to say it, as we're always obliged to say. I mean, this is a question I'm not expecting you to know the exact answer to, but maybe having previewed all of the teams, something you'll have a sense of. How many of, let's say, the 12 most unfancied teams, shall we say, the bottom half of the betting odds, let's say, of this tournament, do you think will adopt a 3 or 5 at the back system? It feels to me like, compared to previous tournaments, that might be happening more and more, something of a trend, if you will. Do you get that sense? And if so, what will that mean for how the games might look? Can we expect another low-scoring tournament as teams go defense first?
I think that's a very good point, Ali, and I'd add to that by saying I think more than usual there's a potential for a lot of sides to move between 3 and 4 at the back. I mean, we've spoken about England, obviously that's a very obvious one, but I think that could be the case with Netherlands in this group, could be the case with Ukraine in this group, could be the case of North Macedonia in this group. So yeah, there's probably more tactical flexibility, and I think it's probably a sign of, you know, a reflection of what's happened at club level over the last few years. I think there are more players who are accustomed to playing in both systems. So, yeah, there's a few uncertainties in terms of shape. You know, Russia, another one, as we mentioned, can play both. So I wouldn't like to put a number on it. But, yeah, I imagine we will see far more than at any tournament, probably more than at any European Championships. Yes, I'd agree.
There is a school of thought that for entertainment purposes, for the neutral, a ton of teams playing 3-5-2 against each other is not necessarily the best for entertainment. But, you know, I'm not here to judge. Tom, before we finish this episode, tell me about a North Macedonian player to watch.
Yeah, I'll go for Elif Elmas, who is probably the star for North Macedonia. He's 21. He's a kind of an attack-minded midfielder who plays for Napoli, formerly at Fenerbahce. And, I mean, he's someone who's super comfortable in possession, really likes to drive the ball forwards from deep, and is a pretty solid one-versus-one dribbler as well. And it's quite a quirky stat where he's in the first percentile, so right at the bottom of all midfielders, for his number of progressive passes. So he barely looks to pass it forward. But he's in the 82nd percentile for the times he looks to progressively carry the ball forward. So someone who is a bit of a ball hog, I guess, in that sense, but also gets a ton of touches in the box from midfielder. 3.2 per 90 is in the top 5% for all midfielders as well. So in your mind, you can kind of build this picture of someone who doesn't really pass from deep, who likes to run with the ball forwards and also attacks the box and makes those late runs in there as well. So he's had to be really versatile for Napoli under Gennaro Gattuso this season as well, and he's played kind of, as you know, from the wings in midfield, both deeper and in an attacking sense. So I think he'll have more of a very much kind of attack-focused role for Macedonia, and if they play with a 3-5-2, he'll be kind of one of the free eights, one of the runners either side of a more traditional holding midfielder. So I'm quite excited to see him play, because his numbers were good at Fenerbahce, and then he's kind of been thrown around the pitch at Napoli, and this is a chance for him to kind of show what, you know, Elmas in his preferred position actually looks like, from my scouting and recruitment analysis point of view.
Really interesting profile of player, that bit of a disruptor in a way. So many good progressive passes in this tournament. Here we've got someone who is allergic to that, but absolutely loves carrying it. I'm all for that. Well, thank you, guys. That's been the preview of Groups A, B and C. Our next episode, which will be live on Wednesday, depending on when you listen to this, it might be out already. So make sure you're subscribed to this podcast feed so that you can get the preview of Groups D, E and F straight to your phone when it is released on Wednesday, the 9th of June, or just shift straight onto that episode now. Do read Tom Warville's the radar piece, which he has alluded to once or twice on this podcast. It has nearly killed the young man, I must admit, but it's going to be an incredible piece to read, and we would push you towards that. Michael's writing throughout the Euros, I'm confident in saying, will be magnificent as well. So if you aren't a subscriber of The Athletic, you can make the most of a really good new offer. Just £1 a month you'll pay for the first 6 months of your annual subscription if you head to theathletic.com/zonal marking to sign up today. And next up for us, it's groups D, E and F. Head to that episode for more Euros 2020 preview content from the Zonal Marking podcast.
The Athletic.